We're going to start the day talking about politics. Summer is supposed to be a slow time for political news, but that is certainly not the case this year. There were some major headlines this week. There were conflicting court rulings pertaining to the Affordable Care Act. There was more debate over the handling of child migrants. And Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, a potential contender for the presidency in 2016, announced a new plan for fighting poverty.
What do we want? We want a healthy economy. And a big part of that is having a safety net that is strong, both for those who cannot help themselves and for those who need just a helping hand to get up and going in life.
Joining us to talk about these and other political stories of the week are two of our trusted analysts, both former White House insiders. Ron Christie is a former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. He's now a Republican strategist, communications advisor, and author. Also with us is Corey Elans. He's a former communications advisor to the Obama administration. He's now a senior vice president at Vox Global. Welcome back to you both. Thanks for coming.
Pleasure to see you.
Good to be here.
So let's start with that poverty plan that Paul Ryan outlined yesterday. It includes expanding the earned income tax credit for people without children and an idea to make that tax credit potentially more useful by allowing people to get the benefit of it throughout the year instead of in a lump sum at tax time. He also wants to combine a number of safety net programs. He says this will streamline the delivery of safety net benefits. Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution, which is a center-left think tank, said his plan shows courage. So, Corey, I'm going to start with you, because that's one of the things that Democrats have been particularly critical about Republicans, that they say that they are very insensitive when it comes to the issue of poverty. They don't care. What do you make of it?
Well, when you take a look at the Ryan plan, it's a classic good news, bad news. The good news is all the things that you outlined, expanding the program to make sure individuals who are in poverty have a chance to get that leg up that they need. And also, this is very much in line with what the Obama administration has put forward as far as their plans to expand EITC. So that is great. The bad news is how he wants to pay for it. And he wants to pay for it two ways, or in multiple ways. One is by taking all of these old programs, these old social programs, and getting rid of them and using those funds to fund the program. The other thing he wants to do is to take a bunch of these programs, block grant those plans, and send them to the states. Now, on one hand, we don't know if any of that is going to be enough to pay for this ultimately. And two, sending programs to the states is analogous to the states having an opportunity to decide if they're going to take on Obamacare or not.
What's wrong with that, though? I mean, the fact that states are the primary deliverers of these kinds of benefits. So
the challenge is that some of these states may decide, you know what, I don't think we're going to do what the federal government is asking us to do with these funds. I think we're going to slow walk it or do nothing. And so it makes the distribution of these resources very uneven. And basically, you're subject to the state that you're in as far as what kind of benefits you may ultimately receive. And that's not a good thing.
So Ron, let's do two things. There is substance and then there is tone. And Congressman Ryan, like, frankly, a number of people in leadership positions in the Republican Party, I'm not just talking about the national level, I'm talking about the state and the local level, have often been criticized for speaking about poverty in a way that is racially coded and offensive. So does this fix that? Does this meet the smell test, in your view, for somebody who is really wanting to open up a conversation?
Yes. I mean, I've known Paul Ryan for almost 25 years, and this is nothing new from his trying to find a way to deliver much-needed services to those who are at most at risk in the safety net, while at the same time ensuring that the states are the best laboratories and the best people to dispense these services to people who need them. I was with the chairman yesterday when he made this announcement, and one of the things, picking up on Corey's point, is that this is not just a lump sum block grant to the states. This is a voluntary program. So a state has to decide, do I want to participate? Yes or no. If I decide I want to participate, here's how I'm going to structure my plan. They would submit their plan to the federal government. Then HHS and the delivery system would say, okay, we're going to take the California approach. So the notion that this is some sort of one-size sort of fits-all block grant isn't true.
Well, tell me how the rest of the Republican caucus is responding to this. What are you hearing so far? I understand it's very new, but what are you hearing?
I'm hearing very positive things, and I have to be perfectly honest with you. Looking at what Paul Ryan has done, looking at what Rand Paul is talking about, this is not your old white guy Republican Party anymore. I think the younger leaders in the Republican Party recognize that in order to expand our base, We need to do what is the simplest thing in politics. Politics is about addition, not subtraction. We need to find ways to appeal to people of color. We need to find ways to appeal to people who are of a different socioeconomic background. And we need to actually find a way to get rid of these social issues, these stigmas that have really traumatized us the last couple cycles. So good for them. That's what I'm hearing on the Hill. People are very, very encouraged by this.
Well, speaking about, you know, another issue that's very kind of emotional and touches on a lot of different issues and also is an issue that speaks to the ability of the parties to attract people of different backgrounds, there was more debate over the handling of the tens of thousands of child migrants, mainly from Central America. Governor Martin O'Malley of Maryland, he's a Democrat, a solidly blue state, told the president not to send kids to a particular site there. They're looking for ways to alleviate the kind of the crowding at the border and the conditions there that I think everybody agrees are not suitable for young children. You know, that caused a big kind of upset. On the one hand, people criticizing the president, other people saying that, well, the Democrats don't have clean hands on this either. So just tell me whether you think that, you know, Corey, how you think this issue is playing out. I mean, has the president done enough? And is the criticism directed toward him justified?
I think the president has done everything that he can do within his power at the moment. And I think what he is advocating is for leaders here in Washington to come together with a real solution to this issue. Not just the narrow issue of children at the border, while as serious as that is, we've had 77,000 children and their families who have come to the border from Central American countries this year. The challenge is, how can we do this in a way that matches the values of our country and our appreciation and history of cherishing immigrants?
Okay, but the bottom line is people say the president's just been slow. He's just been slow off the mark. This is not a secret that these kids are here and that they're coming and that there's a problem.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know
that the president has been slow at all, one. And two, we have to appreciate this issue has doubled. We have doubled the number of kids this year than we had this time last year. And so this, again, is not something that the president can singularly do. And then here's the other part. People who lobby those criticisms are at the same time saying that the president shouldn't be executing, using his authority and executive powers to do more. And that's basically what we saw when the president was in Texas talking to the governor there. The governor says, you need to do more. The president says, tell your Republican friends not to sue me so I can do more. Basically,
we're talking politics with our political insiders, two former White House insiders. That's a former Obama administration advisor, Corey Elans, who was speaking just now. Also with us, Republican strategist, former aide in the George W. Bush administration, Ron Christie. So, you know, Ron, challenges on the Republican side as well. As Corey just mentioned, the Texas governor, also presidential hopeful Rick Perry, he wants to send 1,000 National Guardsmen to the border. Mm-hmm. Some state business leaders are discouraging that. How do you feel that your side of the aisle is handling this issue?
Well, I think as well as could be expected. But ultimately, I think this is one that the president has been asleep at the switch. The president has been detached. The president has not been engaged. How can you have, at the end of the fiscal year, when the Bush administration left power, that we had only 8,000 children from Central America coming, and as Corey accurately points out, you know, we have 76,000 here now. We're going to have 92,000 by the end of the year. This is something the administration was warned about 2 years ago and has done nothing to address it. I think Governor Perry is right, not only to put folks from the National Guard on the border, but most importantly,
what are they going to do?
They need to
ensure.
Are
they going to point their guns at little kids?
No, you don't.
What are they going
to do? You need to ensure that you can act as a backdrop to the Border Patrol, who's frankly busy right now changing with diapers and not dealing with people who are trying to come in our country illegally. Of there are folks who are trying to break in our country. There are people who are trying to come. Let's stop them. Let's put a spotlight on this. I think there's a humanitarian crisis, yes, but what gets me so upset about this is the President of the United States, he's going to meet with the president of Honduras and in Guatemala this Friday. And the important thing here is, why hasn't he been speaking to them before and saying, don't send your children here. They're being raped. They're being mistreated. It's a dangerous journey. Don't let them come here.
Very briefly.
Very quickly. Yeah. Again, the president is doing everything he can within his current powers to deal with this situation and looking at a wide range of issues. The meeting that he's having this week with those leaders is important because they have the ability to send signals to their constituency to say, look, this is a futile game. You don't need to send your kids through muck and mire to get to the border and not have a guarantee that you're going to stay there.
We have to address one more issue before we let you go. So I'll start with you, Corey, because I'm going to give Ron the last word here. I gave you the first word, so I'm going to give him the last word today. Two federal circuit courts issued opposite rulings this week about whether subsidies for the Affordable Care Act are legal. Some legal experts assume this will end up before the Supreme Court. With these subsidies in dispute, there's a new GAO report saying that the program is vulnerable to fraud. I mean, do you still count this as a policy success?
Oh, no question. And
because
evidence comes out every week that says this is a policy success. Number one, right now you have more people who have health care than any time in the history of our country. That is a proven fact. The second is we see the laws working. More than $90 billion has been returned to individuals and families as rebates because insurance companies are either have excessive profits or they're not using those funds to actually provide services and insurance to families. So they're getting those rebates. And then you see overall it's helping us to save money. So the program is definitely working. What you see here this week is a classic argument between the letter of the law versus the interpretation of the law. Mm-hmm. The letter of the law says what it says about having that not applying properly so that it can't be used. The interpretation of the law says, of course, the federal government is able to do this and provide these subsidies.
Let me give Ron a chance to weigh in. And finally, I just want to say that NPR is reporting that 57,000 immigrant kids have come since October, not 70,000 plus. I just want to sort of tell you that this is what our reporting says. Ron, final thought for you, is that the Republicans have, there have been dozens of House votes to repeal or defund the program. Is this a fight still worth having on the Republican side?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's, when Corey says that millions more people have coverage, that's right. But there's a difference between having health care coverage and having access to a doctor. You're finding a lot more providers are denying folks on Medicaid the ability to go to see them because, of course, they're not being fully reimbursed by the federal government. This is very important. The very statute says it's a exchange that is run by the states, that it is entitled for people to have subsidies, not the federal government running an exchange. And a far better lawyer, far brighter mind than mine, Lawrence Tribe, said that within a year or more, the Obamacare that we see now won't exist.
Ron Christie is a Republican strategist. Corey Elans is the Senior Vice President at Vox Global. They were both kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I've appreciated both of your contributions to the program over the years, and thank you both so much. We'll continue talking, perhaps in other venues, so stay with us.
God bless.
Thank you, Michelle.
As the show approaches its final broadcast on August 1st, we've been checking in with some of the many fascinating guests we've had on the program over the last 7 years, especially people who are making transitions of their own. One of them is Beverly Daniel Tatum, the president of Spelman College, the oldest historically black college for women in the country. President Tatum announced earlier this month that she will retire from the post she's held for the past 12 years. During her time there, she has broken new ground, and not just for an historically black college. She's raised more than $157 million in a decade-long fundraising campaign, started a groundbreaking fitness initiative, and Spelman's graduation rate has risen to 79%, the highest among HBCUs. The school was also named one of the 100 best liberal arts colleges by U.S. News & World Report during her tenure. And Beverly Daniel Tatum joins us now to talk more about her career as well as what lies ahead. Welcome back to the program. Congratulations, I guess, is in order.
Thanks so much, Michelle. So glad to be with you today.
Now, you noted in one interview that 12 years is a long time to be a college president these days. Why is that?
Well, it's a very demanding job. It really is 24/7, 365, every day. And so it takes a lot of energy, and it's hard to sustain that much stamina over a long time. I think the average tenure for a private college president is about 6 or 7 years.
Well, why do you think you've been able to hang in there so long?
Regularly scheduled vacations.
Okay, well, that's good advice. Now, we've talked a number of times on this program about the difficulties faced by institutions of higher education in general, but HBCUs in particular, particularly when it comes to things like fundraising and keeping graduation rates up. And I'm wondering, what is it you think about Spelman that has allowed you, what's been a very difficult environment for many institutions, to not only survive, but thrive?
Well, it's true. It's been a tough time for higher education across the board, but I do think in tough times, donors get more selective. And there have been some characteristics for Spelman that have really helped us. One of those things is that our alumni have really rallied. And so when I've been speaking to donors at foundations or private philanthropists or corporate entities, it's a wonderful pride point to be able to say that our alumni support is so strong. Over the course of this campaign, 71% of our graduates made a contribution. But I also think that our donors recognize that it's a really good investment when they make a donation to Spelman. They know that the students they're investing in are very likely to graduate. We have the highest graduation rate for African-American women in the nation. And we take a great deal of pride in the fact that our cost is still relatively low, but we get a very high rate of return.
What I think I hear you saying is that success breeds success. But what's the foundation of that success? Is it that the experience is of such value, that people have such warm feelings about it, that they just can't help but continue to support the institution and the donors are attracted? That what is the foundational experience, you think, or foundational issue, you think, that is kind of the basis upon which these other successes have followed?
Well, I think you're exactly right. Success breeds success. But your question is a great one. I think we have a very powerful and compelling mission. And that goes back to 1881, you know, when the founders of the institution said, we are going to create a college or an institution where we're going to educate women who will be leaders and will go back to educate their own communities. That's a very compelling mission. And there's a long track record of success.
I want to ask about the fitness initiative. You closed the school's intercollegiate sports programs, right, to refocus on wellness for the entire campus, not just for students, but also for faculty and staff. And I just wanted to ask, how did you come to that decision and how hard of a decision was it?
Well, it was initially a challenging decision, but it was one of those moments when I had a stroke of insight, if I might say. We realized that we had a program that was very expensive and benefiting a very small number of students. And there was a moment when I realized that if we reinvested those dollars in a wellness program, we could improve the quality of life for all of our students, particularly when the fact is that adult women, African-American women, are not likely to continue in team sports after graduation. Why continue a high school activity when we could transition them into the kinds of things that adult women do? Yoga, Pilates, fitness walking, jogging. These are the kinds of things that you can do for a lifetime that will help sustain good health.
Was it a difficult decision? I mean, were there tears? I know that you gather the entire kind of student athlete population together to announce it. Was it hard?
There were indeed tears, and it was hard. You know, it was hard to stand in front of 80 student athletes and tell them that something that they loved was going to be phased out. They were angry with me, but at the same time, I knew it was in the best interest of the institution and ultimately in their best interest. They didn't see it that way immediately, but I'm pleased to say that now our student athletes are still engaged in physical activity and they are enjoying the things that we offer.
Did any of them transfer as a consequence of it? I mean, if they were in Division III, you have to assume that if athletics was a priority of theirs, they would have gone somewhere else like Stanford, for example. But did anybody transfer as a result of it?
I'm not aware of any students transferring. There were a number of students who told me that they were thinking about it, but in the end, every student who said that to me returned the following year.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Beverly Daniel Tatum. She's the president of Spelman College. It's considered one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. And she's just announced that after 12 years in that position, she's going to retire at the end of next year. You know, to that end, I wanted to ask you if you think that gender plays any role in why Spelman has been able to create this very unique and special place, both, you know, in higher education, the kind of the higher education firmament. I mean, on all these markers, it's graduation rate, it's loyalty, the fact that the alumni are as devoted to the institution as they are. Do you think gender has something to do with it? And if so, what?
I do think gender plays a role in two ways. One, the uniqueness of the institution. There are only two historically Black college for women in the nation. And so being in that unique position, Spelman being the largest of those two, the other being Bennett College for Women in North Carolina, Spelman being the largest and oldest historically Black college for women gives it a special place in higher education. But in terms of the experience of the students who come, that sense of being part of a sisterhood where they're race, their ethnicity, their gender is taken off the table as barriers to their accomplishment, but really a sense of connection and source of pride really is, I think, an important part of the Spelman experience.
Why do you think, though, that among the other markers for Spelman is that the institution has graduated an extraordinarily large number of the African-American women in STEM fields? A large number of them have spent some time at Spelman. Forgive me for bragging for a moment, but, you know, in the spirit of full disclosure, my beautiful and talented stepdaughter is among them. I mean, after having attended Spelman, she's now an MD-PhD. And so why do you think that is? No thanks to me, by the way. I'm just saying. I cannot take credit for that skill set.
The women who come to Spelman who want to do science are at the center of that educational experience. Unlike in a co-ed environment or a predominantly white environment, the students who were at the front of the room in those experiments, hands-on in the labs, are indeed African-American women or women of African descent. So everywhere you turn, if you're a young woman interested in STEM, you see someone who looks like you who is having success. You see faculty members who look like you. You know graduates who have gone on to graduate schools in places that you might like to attend, who can reach back and say, come to this place because you can be successful here, as I was. I think the power of the role models and the being at the center of the educational enterprise is very empowering.
Are there lessons that you have learned at Spelman that might be applicable to educational leaders in other environments that are not as unique?
I think setting high expectations and holding students accountable for meeting those expectations is tremendously important. I think, unfortunately, there are lots of environments where young people of color find themselves under-expected, if that's a phrase, you know, where expectations are low, where people don't really expect them to achieve at a high level. But that's not the case at HBCUs and certainly not the case at Spelman.
But why do you think, though, that, for example, the graduation rate at Spelman is a full 20 percentage points higher than at what you might call a brother institution, which is Morehouse College, which is an historically Black, very prestigious and highly selective institution for men, which is right across the street? I mean, any thoughts about why that is?
Well, I think there is a gender factor there, right? We know in general that women are graduating at a higher rate across the board, whether you're talking about Black women or white women. Women are graduating at higher rates than men do. So there is a factor built in there. But I also think that Spelman women have a very supportive environment. That's not to say that it's not very supportive at a men's college like Morehouse, but I think the bonding that occurs among the women is very important. That sisterhood carries young women far and wide, and you know, there may be a gender factor there. The expectations, certainly the stereotypes that surround Black women's success are different than those that face young Black men.
What's next for you? I mean, it's been reported that you want to update your famous 1997 book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? It's a book about, you know, having some tough conversations about race. Is that true? Is that part of your plan? And what else is in your future?
Well, it's absolutely true that I'm very eager to think about how the question to that, the question, why are all the Black kids sitting together in the cafeteria, how that question rings in 2014 or 2017, which will mark the 20th anniversary of the publication of that book. And in general, thinking about race relations from the point of view of young people who were born, let's say, in the year 2000, what does it mean to have grown up in the era of the Obama administration, for example. But I'm also quite interested in writing about leadership and thinking about what I've learned as a leader over the course of the last 12, soon to be 13 years at Spelman.
Can you give us a hint, one of those lessons that you might want to pass on about leadership or anything,
you know,
for that matter?
Well, I've really been thinking a lot about what it means to feel a sense of calling. I felt called to Spelman, and there was a tremendous amount of satisfaction in answering that call for the 12 years that I have. And now I feel a sense of time that it is time to pass the baton. I think, you know, being a good leader is knowing when to say it's time for someone else to lead.
Before we let you go, we have a series on our program called Wisdom Watch, and we ask people who have made a difference through their work and their lives to share some knowledge with us, some wisdom with us. Do you have some wisdom to share?
If there's one piece of wisdom that I feel has been important to me and that I would offer to anyone else, it's to listen to the still voice within.
Okay, what does that mean?
When you sit quietly and meditate on a question or think about something, you know, you asked earlier about intercollegiate athletics. It was in a moment of quiet that I had the realization that we should do something different. And it was in a moment of quiet that I realized it was time for me to step down from Spelman. It was also in a moment of quiet that I realized it was time for me to go to Spelman back in 2002. So I find that listening to that still small voice within in moments of quiet will always steer you in the right direction.
Beverly Daniel Tatum is president of Spelman College. This upcoming academic year will be her last in that position. I do also want to mention that another colleague at another Atlanta-based historically black college, Dr. Carlton E. Brown of Clark Atlanta University, will also be stepping down next year. We want to wish him well as well. President Tatum was kind enough to join us from member station WCLK in Atlanta. President Tatum, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
I wish the same to you. Thanks so much for creating this opportunity.
And now it's time for the regular feature we call In Your Ear. As we wind down production, you know our last show is August 1st, we've been hearing the favorite music of members of the Tell Me More team. In a few minutes, we're going to head into our barbershop roundtable, and we're glad that fans of the shop enjoy the conversation. But what you might not know is that there's a lot of work behind the scenes to make that happen. For some time now, producer Bridget DeShagas has been the unseen queen behind the scenes at the barbershop, helping the guys select the topics and sharpen their arguments before they go on the air. As you might imagine, they can be quite a handful. So here are some of the songs that keep her energy up.
Hi, this is Bridget DeShagas. I am responsible for the barbershop segment that you hear every Friday. That's been my signature segment, and sometimes people call me the barbershop queen.
Yo, VIP. Let's kick it.
This is what's playing in my ear. My all-time favorite song, I was 12, sixth grade when the song came out, is Ice, Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice. And even to this day, like, it had to be played at my wedding. It's like the number one song you can play to get me on the dance floor.
Dance, crush the speaker that booms. I'm killing your brain like a poisonous mushroom. Deadly, when I play a dope melody, anything less than the best is a felony. Love it or leave it, you better gain weight. You better hit bulls out of kid.
Here's a little bit of the verse I really like. All right, stop. Collaborate and listen. Ice is back with a brand new invention. Something. Grab the hold of me tightly. Flow like a harpoon daily and nightly. Would I ever stop? Yo, I don't know. Turn off the lights and I'll glow. To the extreme, rack mic like a vandal. Light up the stage, max chomp like a candle.
Dance.
Okay, yes, that is a white girl rapping.
If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook while my DJ revolves it.
The other song that I really like is, not surprisingly, Eminem. I loved his song, The Real Slim Shady.
Y'all act like you never seen a white person before. Jaws all on the floor like Pam, like Tommy just burst in the door. We started whooping her ass worse than before. They first were divorced, sewing her over furniture. It's the return of the... Oh, wait, no, wait, you're kidding. He didn't just say what I think he did he?
I remember, I think it was the 2000 MTV Music Awards where he had like 100 Slim Shadys all in their jeans and white t-shirts lined up on stage, and I just thought he was so awesome.
Slim Shady, yes, I'm the real Shady. All you other Slim Shadys are just imitating. So won't the real Slim Shady please stand up? Please stand up. Please stand up.
I just think he really is who he is, and that's a kid who grew up in urban Detroit. And he's owned that, and he's made a lot of money being who he is, and major props to him. Another song that I really like is Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight. Oh, Lord.
I just, every time I hear that song, it takes me back and it reminds me of like driving through the night through the Grand Canyon, because my father bought that album when we were kids. I think I was about 8 years old. And he played it on this trip to California, like, almost the whole time. And it reminds me of that trip, and it reminds me of my dad. And it reminds me of his ability to pack up his kids in his car every summer and drive across country. And it just makes me happy.
That was Tell Me More producer and editor Bridget DeShegas telling us what's playing in her ear. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Lawyer and National Review contributor Mario Loyola is with us from Austin, Texas. In St. Louis, Christopher Ave, political editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and in our Washington, D.C. studios, contributing editor for The Root, Corey Day. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Super Mario, Ave, what's up, everybody?
Bittersweet. Bittersweet, my
welcome
friend.
Welcome to the shop. Yeah, no doubt, but we're going to make it through, man.
That's
the four of us, man. I got the
hey,
shoulder
I,
right
Chapman?
Here for you,
what?
Big brother. Michelle, you always get
thank
you know you always get this shoulder. You
oh,
know that.
Thank you.
You know this.
Thank you.
All right, well, you know, let's get it started. Hashtag Black Eyed Peas. President Obama is on the record talking about acting white, and you can finally get some sleep. A young Native man asked at my brother's keeper's town hall meeting about how to succeed and still respect his own heritage. And so the president got personal. Drop that clip, please.
African Americans in communities where I've worked, there's been notion of acting white, which sometimes is overstated, but there's an element of truth to it where, okay, if boys are reading too much, then, well, why are you doing that? Or why are you speaking so properly? And the notion that there's some authentic way of being black, that if you're going to be black, you have to act a certain way and wear a certain kind of clothes, that has to go.
All right. Well, you know, not to get all Franz Fanon on you guys, but he said that oppressed people are always struggling to find some value on their proximity to the oppressor, that, you know, the more they fit into that conventional box, the more authentic they are perceived to be, hashtag wretched of the earth. Now, me personally, I say do you, and every day, or at least every other day, my blackness is called in question. You know, my dearly departed wife, I love you to death, but she used to say, you know, you might have to re-up your membership. Your membership is under consideration.
Wait, Jimmy.
Wait, that was because of the sarongs, yo. That wasn't
real talk.
Jimmy,
real
you're,
talk. Well,
Jimmy, you're
go
black?
Okay, C. Dave, go ahead. The green-eyed bandits in the house. What's your take?
I mean, first and foremost, the president of the United States, leader of the free world, is addressing the challenge of code switching that presses people of color. That is a pretty phenomenal thing. When he leaves office, that's something that's going to go away as somebody who's the president has the power to elevate a conversation that has been a plague on the people of color in America since we got here. That's a pretty big thing. Now, all that said, any black person who's educated or has pursued education and success has been questioned about their blackness by other black people since time immemorial. It goes with the territory. I think, you know, they're always haters. But the truth of the matter is the haters often conflate pursuit of excellence or trying to improve your station with leaving other black people behind. Obama is saying, and I think what we probably all will agree with, is you can pursue excellence, you can pursue education, a higher standard of living, et cetera, all those things, and still have racial solidarity and still have cultural solidarity.
Let's make this clear. Thank you for that, Corey Day. But, you know, I gotta push back a little bit because my man Fanon, he finessed it. And he said, you know, this is a colonial phenomenon. This isn't necessarily an American phenomenon. This is everywhere that people have been enslaved and or colonized.
Absolutely.
So let's go with that because I love this country. Christopher Ave, as a white guy, really? Have you ever been accused of acting outside your race or culture?
You know, I got to say, I'm not cool enough to ever having been accused of acting outside my race. I mean, I'm sorry. There's too much white bread in this sandwich, if you know what I mean.
Let me ask you this, though.
The fact is, I'm thinking about the fact that every group has an anti-intellectual cohort. I mean, anybody who's been to high school knows that there's people who are accused of being gunners. You know what I mean? In grad school, they call it a gunner. It's like, oh, you got your hand up all the time. That's not racial. Mm. So the part that bothers me about this, why is this racialized all of a sudden, that this becomes kind of a racial identity as opposed to just there's anti-intellectualism exists everywhere.
No, I agree with that. And I tell you, I see it in my own family. My mother is from rural East Texas. My wife's family is from rural Oklahoma. My kids, they will look at me as we're driving to Oklahoma and they'll say, Daddy, how come every time we go to Oklahoma, you say y'all? And it's true. It comes out. As my mama says, I come by it natural. I mean, it comes out of me when I'm on the road to rural America. So, yeah, I agree. It's not all racial.
He get it from his mama.
What about Christopher? I was going to say he gets it from his mama, Super Mario. Mi hermano, you're a proud Republican and Latino. You get any grief for this?
No, that's the grief that I would get on that. It would probably come from somebody who is not a native speaker of Spanish, which I am. And so they wouldn't be in a good position to criticize me for not being Latino enough on political grounds when culturally I'm probably going to be more Latino than they are.
But what about that, though?
I mean,
is there like language chasing, though? I mean, have you ever had somebody, like if you spoke, if somebody knew that you were of Latino heritage and you spoke English to them, I have had Latino friends of mine say, well, people say, what are you, too good to speak your language?
That depends on what part of the country you're in. I mean, on the East Coast, I've noticed that people love it when, you know, that native speakers of Spanish love it when you speak Spanish to them. And in Texas, you got to be careful because a lot of the Tejanos don't like it when you speak Spanish to them. I mean, you just sort of have to be culturally sensitive to the location where you are. When I arrive in Miami and I don't speak English to anybody, even if they're blonde-haired, blue-eyed, I mean, everyone's Cuban in Miami, at least where my family is. And so
do you feel, though, that the sort of impressions of, do you ever feel like you were bound by impressions of what you were supposed to be?
No.
No.
All righty.
Well, so there it is.
I mean, and in that sense, by the way, the president's message is a very valuable one for kids. I mean, but I took the president to be saying, you know, look, it's okay to be yourself. Don't buy into other people's stereotypes. You don't have to fit into anyone else's mold. And that's a very valuable message for the president to be saying. And, you know, he's really at his best when it comes to race because he really is able to see things from different people's point of view. And I almost can't believe it's the same person who spends the rest of the year saying really insulting and, frankly, unintelligent things about Republicans. But anyway.
Oh, my God. There it is.
You could be what you want to be unless it's a Democrat. That's it. If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, constitutional lawyer Mario Loyola, journalist Corey Date, and Christopher Ave. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, well, check this out. New York City officials approve what's being called a poor door. That's right. It's a separate entrance that affordable housing residents will use in a luxury apartment building. Now, guess what? Now, hold on. Now, listen up. Now, for those of us paying a pretty penny to live in a nice building, this might not be the worst idea I've heard come down the pike. See, in my building, they might need like a goth door because I get on the elevator with people dressed like Trent Reznor in long, dark, black trench coats. It makes me nervous. And I'm thinking about making a petition in my building for a goth door. But real talk, you don't know who all is getting in your building. Next thing you know, the people you get in your building with, they might have lower money standards. They might be in your house trying to see what you got. And I don't know. It might not be the worst idea. Super Mario, what do you think?
Well, I love this story because the progressives who regulate housing in New York City are so, oh my God, it's segregated housing. This is like servants' quarter. It's horrible. And I'm here to tell you that they have absolutely nobody to blame but themselves. This is 100% the fault of
because
the inclusionary housing program that's at the root of this is a tax incentive for big new projects if a certain percentage of the project is affordable housing. So it's basically an economic penalty on people who don't do it that way. And then, in effect, that requires either separate buildings or segregated buildings because the people who are in affordable housing can't afford to pay for the gym, the sauna, the pool, the doorman. So you have to exclude them from those services, right? So in other words, you have to segregate them. And the entire problem starts with stuff like rent control that creates a scarcity of non-rent control housing in New York City, which raises the price of non-rent control housing, which is why the new construction in New York City is all luxury apartments. And it's a wonderful comeuppance for progressives who don't think before they pass an ordinance.
You know, it's interesting, Corey Dade, because I've heard the same thing about San Francisco, where people say that the rent control is so tough, it's tilted toward renters as opposed to owners, that actually owners hoard housing. They'd rather keep it empty than rent it and not be able to get rid of somebody or raise the rent. So I don't know. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a problem in San Francisco. You see that also in Boston. Not so much here in D.C., but I think there's I'd like to draw a distinction between rent control and the development, the sort of community, the urban redevelopment tools that have brought affordable housing mixed with market on market housing and a poor door. Those two things don't go together. We've been doing in major cities major developments that include components for affordable housing in on-market properties for decades now. None of them have included a poor door. For me, this is more about New York being New York. For New York, New York has become this city of the rich versus the poor, with the rich winning.
Well, I don't see that poor people are going to live in these houses. I mean, I think if you're talking about affordable housing in New York, it's going to be a nurse. It's going to be the person teaching your kids in kindergarten. It's going to be the firefighter who's going to put the fire out if, you know, God forbid, your building.
There's nothing.
And it's going to be the police officer guarding your street. That's who's going to be in affordable housing.
Right. Affordable is relative to the city, to the income of each profession, but also in each city, the cost of living.
Basically, it sounds like you agree with Mario, though. You're just saying this is a particularly crude approach here. You're saying that it really is about kind of the regulation of the housing space, and this is a crude
This as housing policy. I look at this as to the extent I agree with Mario, I agree that this is sort of a bastardization of what has been effective housing in some ways.
Okay.
I think this is just absurd.
All right. Christopher, quick thought from you?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, it's horrible, it's insulting, and I'd be the first in line for that poor door, because you double my salary, I'd still need it in New York City.
All right.
Well, go ahead, Jimmy.
Well, I'm there. I'm using it. I'm sorry.
You're using it.
Ain't too proud to beg.
Going in through the outdoor.
He gets it natural.
Hashtag raspberry beret. So let's go on. Always moving. We're talking about somebody who can use any door he wants. That's Donald Sterling. He's still trying to hold on to the L.A. Clippers after being on blast, my dude, for making – he's not my dude. Don't do that. But he made some racist remarks. Until recently, Clippers coach Doc Rivers was kind of stepped around the whole question about whether Sterling should stay or go as owner. But now the interim CEO of the Clippers says Coach Rivers may walk if Sterling won't. Guys, you know, just about everybody but the Pope is saying Sterling has to go. And me, so me and the Pope are in good company. That's my dude. Christopher, what's your take?
Well, if you remember when this controversy first came out, I remember watching Doc Rivers' face and the look of agony and the pain. I mean, here's a guy who's only been there a year. He's trying to make the team go. He's wondering if the team's even going to play. This tears at him. I think this guy's got integrity, and I'm with him. I mean, I think this is a completely appropriate thing to do. I think Sterling is the only one in the room, as you say, who doesn't understand it is time to go.
What about Mario? Mario, I don't think we've talked to you about Sterling. What do you think?
My favorite topic. Well, I'm troubled by the principle that you can be banned by an organization for things you said in an illegal recording of a private conversation. But on the other hand, I believe that private organizations should be able to exclude whomever they want for whatever reason they want, and it's wonderful to see so many progressives standing up for freedom of association over privacy rights, because you're not going to see that too often. So.
Wow.
Okay.
Corey.
Go ahead. Corey, what do you think?
Look, I'm going to focus on – I've said plenty about Donald Sterling up here in the shop, but I'm going to focus on Doc Rivers. After Greg Popovich of the San Antonio Spurs, Doc Rivers is the most respected coach in the NBA. If he decides that he's going to quit, that is huge. That would be perhaps one of the biggest – moves of social protests in the history of professional sports in America. Let's just not.
Isn't that like fundamental labor rights? You have a right to determine where your labor is used. If you have agents, you know, despite the fact that these are highly controlled workforces, unlike other places,
you can say,
I don't want to work for you anymore.
Yeah, and that's, you know, he is under contract, but at the same time, he can walk away. I don't think that's going to happen. Let's just put that out there. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think it's good that Rivers is continuing to put this out there, because it puts pressure on the NBA to resolve this quickly before the start of the season. They cannot afford for Sterling to still be in the league at the start of the season, and they certainly can't afford for Rivers, the most decorated coach behind Popovich, to leave.
They also, you know, also Chris Paul says it's reported that he has also said that he'll sit out if Sterling stays. So look, we just have a minute or so left, and I just have to ask you, I don't have to. I'm going to ask you about the spreadsheet that went viral recently. A man reportedly sent his wife a list of all the times he tried to initiate romance and all of the reasons she said no, from being tired to watching her favorite television program. Christopher, you really wanted to talk about this. That's because
yeah, I think this is clearly a triumph for STEM and for technological education. The popularity, it's been shared billions of times across the world. So I'm all for it. No, it's ridiculous.
Okay.
You got to have a conversation. Don't post. Don't send your spouse an email with an attachment of a spreadsheet. My gosh.
Corey, you and your friends had a field day with this on Facebook.
Man.
Exactly.
Which you don't think we read, but we did.
Oh,
man.
You forget that we're Facebook friends, and yes, I know what you were saying, so why don't you just spill it?
All I could say is what was interesting is shortly thereafter, another woman, a separate woman, did the same thing. She posted a spreadsheet of the times when her husband said no, and consequently, they're divorced.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Mm.
So
just
I think as entertaining as it is, it ain't worth the salt to go that route. I'm just going to say.
Well.
Go ahead. Mario, you're not married, so I don't know. Maybe this is probably not part of your life, but what?
Michelle.
Go ahead, Jimmy. You want to?
I was going to say, well, Michelle, you knew my wife. I didn't get enough sleep to even think about doing any kind of Excel sheet. So.
Yes.
Team Israel.
She was juicy.
That's how we got down.
She was definitely juicy.
Baller.
So, I know, right? Mario, you got any final thoughts here? You have any advice for this gentleman who seems to be having some difficulties?
I'm under the general impression that women really like romance and that it makes them very happy. So if your chica is not in a romantic mood, you're probably not doing something.
You're doing it wrong.
That's it.
All right, good. We're having a little wisdom watch and barbershop all in one. Okay. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Christopher Ave is the political editor at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Corey Date is contributing editor for The Root. He runs their political blog, The Take. And Mario Loyola is a constitutional lawyer and columnist for the National Review. Thank you all so much.
Good job.
Yeah!
And remember, if you can't get enough barbershop buzz on the radio, look for our barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. Be sure to tune into the Barbershop next Friday, where the guys join us live with a studio audience. We do not want to miss that. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.